Testing, 1, 2, 3, 4. Testing, 1, 2, 3, 4. Testing, 1, 2, 3, 4. Testing, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Afternoon.
Glad to have such a great turnout. We would have charged admission if we knew we were going to have this many. So we could have bought more cameras that way. We're going to be, well, first of all, do we have still some people outside? To the Sergeant of Arms, if there's somebody outside who does not have a representative in here and is there we're doubling up on some inside, if we might make a change there. I want as many organizations and groups to get in as possible.
We've got about 15 out there representing.
Oh my goodness.
We can stand them on the side or over there, and that's up to you.
You gonna watch for the fire marshal?
Well, he's probably out in the hallway, sir, waiting here with Bob Bonner working.
Maybe. Well, I would like to have those in here if we can get them in. That's fine. Yeah, we may be told we have to make a change, but let's get them in here if we can. While they're doing that, I'm going to go ahead and call the meeting to order because we have quite a bit to cover today. This is the Subcommittee on Body-Worn Cameras of the Joint Legislative Oversight Committee on Justice and Public Safety. I'm Representative John Faircloth, and Representative McNeil is here. We are the co-chairs of this particular subcommittee, and our intent for this particular committee is to probably meet three times altogether. We've tried to put it into workable subjects and getting around to as many interests and stakeholders as possible. Many of you are here today, and there are others that have not come that will probably be coming the next time. I appreciate the interest in this subject. It obviously has wide-ranging concern for a lot of us. And from our standpoint as legislators, we're probably going to have to try to do something in the short session that will help you out there in the field. We don't know yet exactly what our path is going to be, but some of that you'll hear about today in the presentations. This is a subject that concerns virtually everybody. We have the law enforcement folks out there trying to do the job on the street. We have the folks who come in contact with law enforcement officers, either in a good way or perhaps in a less good way. We have cities and counties that have liability concerns. We have the media that has concern on having information for their public. And we have the public that is concerned to have the information they feel they should have. So we've got a lot of questions to answer. And those of you who are here hopefully can help us do a lot of that, find a lot of those answers as we go along this trip. What we will do is we have several presenters. We'll ask the presenters to come up, and they'll give us their information. I'll ask that committee members, if we can hold our questions until the presenters get through what they're presenting, and then we can ask your questions. Glad to have Representative Hurley here, Representative Speciale, Representative Haynes. Senator Robinson just came in. Thanks for coming in. And so with that, we'll get underway. Now, we will get to the point that we'll ask if you have questions from the audience. And when you do, we'd like for you to stand up and give us your name and title, because we are recording this and we'd like to have a record. Very quickly, I know it takes time, but very quickly, I'd like to start over here and go around and just introduce yourself, your name, and the organization you might represent. So if we start over here.
My name is Todd Carver. I'm with the Iredell County Sheriff's Office.
Stand up as we go around, if you don't mind. Okay.
Susanna Birdsong with ACLU.
Jim Clark, I'm the police attorney for the Greensboro Police Department. Rodney Hilliard with the Buncombe County Sheriff's Office.
Andy Caldwell with the North Carolina Sheriff's Association.
Crystal Cody, Charlotte Mecklenburg Police. Linda Fox, Charlotte Mecklenburg Police Attorney's Office.
Rick Stevens, I'm the Sheriff's Attorney for Guilford County.
Jim Secor, Sheriff's Attorney for Guilford County.
Kevin Alton, Rowan County Sheriff.
Billy
Jones,
General Systems.
Thank you.
Bueller United Network Corporation.
Robert West, North Carolina Highway Patrol.
Brian Main, Sheriff of Allegheny County.
Justin West, Allegheny County Sheriff's Office.
Jim Collins, Allegheny County Sheriff's Office.
Justin Flynn, Greensboro Police Department.
Joel Crafter, Greensboro Police Department.
Fred Baggett, North Carolina Association of Chiefs of Police. Jeff Gray, North Carolina Patrol. Mike Wilson,
North Carolina Department of Public Safety.
Second row in there.
David Carroll, North Carolina Sheriff's Association.
Jeff Welty with the School of Government.
Billy West, District Attorney, Compton County, Compton
System. Tom Adams, Chief of Police, City of Hickory.
David Upper, Executive Director of the Governor's Crime Commission.
Jamie McDonald, Henderson
County
Sheriff's Office.
Sheriff Charlie McDonald, Henderson County.
Lynn Hagman, Sheriff, Watauga County.
Kelly Redmond, Watauga County Sheriff's Office.
First row.
Michael Kudrick, North Carolina Justice Academy.
I'm Ed Turlington of the Brooks Pierce Law Firm.
Cameron Tobin, State Highway Patrol.
Brent Sutherland, North Carolina State Highway Patrol.
Harold Medlock for the Fayetteville Police Department.
Ryan Combs, North Carolina Department of Public Safety.
Jennifer Schneider, Greensboro City Attorney's Office.
Okay.
Van Duncan, Sheriff Buncombe County.
Okay.
And the P. Jerry Williams, representative of the North Carolina Law Brokers Association. Okay. Steve Wells from Charlotte Mecklenburg Police Department.
Peg Doyle with Compton's Division.
Ashton Godwin, Wildlife Commission.
Chris Huebner, Wildlife Commission.
Joe Parisi, Cumberland County Sheriff's Office. William Hart, for Director John Burris, State Crime.
Thank you so much. I don't recall very many subcommittees that had this kind of an audience, so you can see what the interest is. We'll have to probably have a, for the staff's use, we probably have to have a larger room next time around.
Okay.
All right, let me give you just a short explanation of where we are at this point. You will hear today about the two bills that were introduced last year. There were actually three bills. Representative Haynes had a grant bill, and then we had the other two bills that you hear about today. The two bills are alive over in the Senate. They're being held captive, but they're alive over there. And so we have vehicles available if we can get to the point of having some recommended legislation, which with the whole JPS committee would recommend. We can also, of course, the committee can recommend the bill, too. So we have a way to move forward in the short session if everything can come together. If not, we may have to go into next year. Our purpose here today is we have some selected groups that we're going to hear from to sort of give us an idea of where we are, what's out there in the field that the officers are already using, what are the rules of use or whatever might have been developed at by the local governments to apply to what's being done there. Any opinions on what might be needed, you're welcome to let us hear some of that. What we want to do is sort of get a feel for those of you who are here today. Then the next time around, we're going to broaden it, and we want to get information then from citizens groups. We want to get information from the media. We want to get information from district attorneys' groups, because there's an awful lot of impact that this project has. So let's get started. Representative McNeil, do you have anything you'd like to say?
Well, just welcome. I'm impressed by the turnout, and just to kind of piggyback off what Chairman Fairclough already said, it's evident that this is a very, very sensitive and important issue in the state of North Carolina. And this subcommittee and then the full committee, when we report to it later, I think in April, is interested in coming up with a solution that's going to make this issue better for everyone concerned. And like Representative Fairclough said, you know, I know there's a lot of you that have asked to make a presentation. Obviously, we couldn't fit everything in today, but we do have two other meetings, and we will do our best to make sure that everybody has the opportunity to have input into what we will eventually hopefully craft some legislation that will hopefully, I know it won't solve this issue. I think anybody that thinks that body cameras are going to solve all the issues in law enforcement is probably mistaken. But at least it might carry us forward and at least help in certain situations. So, but it's good to see you all here. And please, we're here. We're kind of a blank slate, and we want to hear your opinions and your facts on this issue.
Thank you, sir. Our first speaker is Jan Paul, committee counsel, who will update us on current NC law governing body-worn cameras. Jan?
Good afternoon. My name is Jan Paul. I'm a staff attorney with the Legislative Analysis Division of the General Assembly, and I was asked to give an overview of NC law. I'm going to give a little bit broader overview, starting with the overview of current law from the federal government on down to the states, so that you can get an idea of what the General Assembly's legislation may have to address. With regard to federal activities, the Presidential Task Force on 21st Century Policing issued an over 100-page final report in May of 2015, and that is on the U.S. Department of Justice website, Community-Oriented Policing Services, or known as COPS. You can find that, if you wish, on the website. That particular report and that task force discussed a lot of issues, one of which was focused on technology and social media, and that was their third session, or what they call their third pillar. And that particular session provided the committee with testimony on research and legal considerations that related to the use of body-worn cameras and other technologies, as well as considerations that related to implementing those technologies in the face of privacy issues, which need to be balanced according to the report. The relevant findings are on page 31 of the report, and I have provided to the members, and this will be put on the website, our committee website. You can access the website for that report. The full final report is listed on that website. Also on this resource listing that I've provided and will be on the subcommittee website will be several other reports: police officer body-worn cameras, assessing the evidence, put out by the Office of Justice Programs Diagnostic Center, implementing a body-worn camera program, recommendations and lessons learned, which was put out by the Community-Oriented Policing Services of the U.S. Department of Justice, and then the National Body-Worn Camera Toolkit, which is also put out by the U.S. Department of Justice. And all of those taken together give a pretty broad overview of concerns of pretty much all stakeholders that would have a voice in this issue, everything from the ACLU to law enforcement to legislatures and legal and constitutional issues that may relate to body-worn cameras. A specific relevance to this subcommittee were two specific recommendations of that committee. And recommendation 3.2, in that recommendation, the observation was made, while standards should be created for development and research of technology at the national level, implementation of developed technology should remain a local decision to address the needs and resources of its community. Recommendation 3.3 is that the U.S. Department of Justice should develop best practices that can be adopted by state legislative bodies to govern the acquisition, use, retention, and dissemination of auditory, visual, and biometric data by law enforcement. So those are just a couple of the recommendations that came from this third pillar, but that would be of specific interest to this subcommittee. With regard to federal bills, there are a number of bills that have been introduced in the U.S. Congress, in the House of Representatives. None of them are currently moving right now. They've just been introduced. I think some of the analysts indicate their opinion that they're waiting to see what the states are doing. Some of the bills establish grant programs for states and localities to do body-worn camera pilot programs. So there are bills, and those bills in the Congress are listed under names such as, the Safer Officers and Safer Citizens Act of 2015, the Police Camera Act, and you're certainly welcome to look at those and to see what the contents are of those federal bills. The 2016 Commerce, Justice, State Appropriations Bill passed the House of Representatives. A new piece is the Commerce Trust Initiative, and it allocates $50 million for purchase of body-worn cameras, $15 million of that going to pilot programs, $30 million for justice reform and collaborative efforts, and $5 million for improved statistics collection. That is currently, we are currently seeing some movement on that. With regard to state activities overview, at least 37 states to date have considered legislation to address at least some aspect of body-worn cameras for law enforcement officers. South Carolina was the first state to require all law enforcement agencies in the state to use body-worn cameras. 15 states enacted new laws just last year, and altogether 21 states and the District of Columbia have enacted either laws or resolutions on police cameras so far. In addition, there are a lot of municipalities such as Denver, Phoenix, and Mesa, and Rialto, California, that are conducting or they have conducted studies prior to implementing any programs or pilot programs, and they're looking into issues such as evidentiary issues, funding, how data impacts open records laws, what police department policy should be prior to implementation. And they have looked into practical and constitutional considerations that may have a bearing on legislation, such as the transparency issues versus privacy issues versus accountability issues, cost of buying and maintaining the equipment, how long and where to store the recordings, cost of storage, any limits of recording in certain protected areas, and the development of appropriate regulations for police use, just for example, as part of the laundry list of topics and issues that are being considered. In North Carolina, under current law, there is no North Carolina law currently specifically addressing body-worn cameras. The only reference to body-worn cameras in our statute currently are in the Appropriations Act, which Ms. Leggett will discuss in the budget, Session Law 2015-241. Right now, any governance of body-worn camera programs at the state level would come from various provisions that are scattered in various places of the statute. The most significant ones are the public records law. One of them is the public records law in Chapter 132 of the North Carolina General Statutes, which governs public records law in North Carolina, determines what access law enforcement agencies may or must provide to body-worn cameras, or it could address it, although again, at this point in time, absent legislation, body-worn cameras are not mentioned specifically. Under our public records law, in general, records of government agencies are open to the public, but our public records law does contain an exception for records of criminal investigations. So under GS-132-1.4, records that are created in connection with criminal investigations conducted by law enforcement agencies are not public records as defined under the chapter. What this means, then, is that the public would not have a general right of access to the records, but law enforcement agencies are not completely prohibited from releasing them. And furthermore, records of criminal investigations that are conducted by public law enforcement agencies or records of criminal intelligence information may be released under a court order. Records of criminal investigations and records of criminal intelligence information are defined in the statute. Records of criminal investigations means information derived from witnesses, laboratory tests, surveillance, investigators, confidential informants, photographs and measurements, and also includes specified records of the state crime lab. Records of criminal intelligence information means records or information that pertain to a group of person or persons compiled by a public law agency in an effort to anticipate, prevent, or monitor possible violations of the law. Again, currently recordings from body-worn and in-car cameras are not included in this definition under GS-132-1.4. The other major area is personnel laws, and the laws that pertain to personnel records, again, are contained in different chapters of the general statutes. Article 7 of Chapter 126 governs the privacy of state employee personnel records, and with only specific exceptions that are enumerated in the statutes that do allow access to certain records or information in personnel files, in general, personnel files of state employees are confidential and cannot be either released or subject to inspection or examination under the public records laws. And again, that's except for certain information that is required to be maintained as a separate public record. It's possible that at least some content in law enforcement videos would constitute confidential personnel records under North Carolina law. For example, if body camera footage becomes a personnel record because it is used as a basis for performance evaluations or disciplinary actions of officers, then it would be confidential and not subject to release under the current law. And local government employee personnel files are also similarly protected under GS-160A-168, so records gathered by a city or county regarding its employees are also confidential. In addition, state records retention law archives schedule has recently been changed in response to concerns about body-worn cameras, and there is a specific provision regarding retention of records that come from law enforcement mobile unit videotapes. Video from cameras generally are wirelessly downloaded to a secure server, and they're to be kept for 30 days unless they're going to be used in a criminal case. So destruction of videos is governed by state records retention schedules, and municipal records retention schedules requires mobile unit videotapes, again, to be retained for at least 30 days, after which they can be destroyed. Some local governments may have policies requiring a longer retention period, and records that become part of a case file or a personnel file will no longer have required retention periods under the applicable schedule provisions. With regard to bills that are currently moving through the General Assembly that the members referenced, House Bill 713 is entitled Body and Dash Cam Recording Public Access. I provided in the packets the most recent edition, the second edition of that bill, as well as a recent bill summary that I've prepared that essentially summarizes the bill. It gives a summary of the current law. What this bill would do would add to the definition of records of criminal investigations that I read to you earlier, specifically recordings of body-worn cameras or in-car cameras of law enforcement officers, and that would exclude them specifically from the definition of public records. That particular bill would require any individual that is trying to get a court order for access to recordings of body-worn cameras or in-car cameras to specify, and the language in the bill is with reasonable particularity, the portion of the recording that has the required information. Could be the date and time of the incident, the identity of anyone involved in the incident, the identity of the officer, the location of the incident. There are various factors that need to be taken into consideration, generally to comprise with reasonable particularity. However, the bill says, notwithstanding any other state laws that regulate or prohibit access to employee personnel records, a law enforcement agency may release recordings, and that's discretionary, release recordings captured by body-worn cameras or in-car cameras without the consent of the officer whose actions are documented or captured on the film. But a law enforcement agency is not required to allow access to those recordings. And then it also clarifies that any federal law, and as I indicated earlier, there are no current federal laws containing minimum standards or guidelines at this point, but that any federal law governing access to the types of recordings would not be superseded by state law. The other bill moving through the General Assembly, and both of these bills are in Senate rules. They passed the House in late April and moved across to Senate rules in late April, where they remain in Senate rules. Is House Bill 811. Again, the bill is attached and handed out to everyone, and that particular bill would be a study bill. And if you look at the bill summary, it was prepared by our committee, the committee counsel to House Judiciary 1 at the time this left the House and crossed over to the Senate. It indicates essentially that the Criminal Justice Education and Training Standards Commission and the Sheriff's Education and Training Standards Commission would have a joint study regarding implementing and using body-worn cameras, that they are allowed to consult with any other agencies that may be able to provide pertinent information, including UNC Chapel Hill School of Government. And there's a drop-down list, which you can read, and again, it'll be put on our website if you didn't get a copy when you came in today, discussing everything that should be studied by these commissions. Body-worn camera it was defined for purposes of the study bill, and the study would be reported with its findings and recommendations, including any legislation or legislative proposals during the short session. And it would be effective when it becomes law. And I just wanted to, again, just point you to these resources, the police officers' body-worn cameras. It's quite a lengthy study, implementing a body-worn camera program, a lengthy study. There are competing interests that are discussed in all of these reports, and I would strongly recommend and commend them to you to assist you and the members of the committee in determining what law would be appropriate for the General Assembly. And I know that one thing that this committee will be considering and discussing is what, if any, state minimum standards or guidelines should be set, and what should be determined at the local level through either policies, procedures, and perhaps ordinances. And with that, that concludes my, my performance.
Are there any questions for committee members?
Thank you
so much. Appreciate that. Well, we don't let you rest long, do we? Summary, you did that. Guidelines and standards for body-worn camera grants. Christine Leggett, would you come forward and just introduce this concern to us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. last year in the budget bill, the General Assembly appropriated $2.5 million non-recurring in both years of the biennium for body-worn camera grants. Those funds were appropriated to the Governor's Crime Commission, who was going to determine policies and guidelines governing the distribution of the grants and then distribute them. The maximum grant amount was up to $100,000. This is for local law enforcement or state law enforcement agencies. Recipient law enforcement agencies were required to provide a 2-to-1 match. So for every $1 they got in grant money, they had to put up $2. And then finally, grantees are required to have appropriate policies and procedures in place governing the operation of the cameras and proper storage of the images recorded with the cameras. The provision also required the Governor's Crime Commission to make several reports regarding these grants, and the first report was received by the General Assembly in November. Sheriff Huffman from the Governor's Crime Commission is here to discuss their what policies and guidelines they have created and how the awards process is going so far.
Thank you. Mr. Huffman, would you come forward?
I'm David Huffman, Executive Director for the Crime Commission, for the Governor's Crime Commission, and we were, and thank you so much, Mr. Chairman, for giving me the opportunity to speak to the group today. We were tasked with the duty of pass-through money from the General Assembly, and we began to set up some guidelines as best we could, because this is one of the first times that we've been able to do this through the Crime Commission and with the amount of money that was involved. And like Christine said, with the sum of $250,000, I'm sorry, $2,500,000 non-recurring funds for the fiscal year 15 and 16 year, the funds have also been used for can be used for training and related expenses of body-worn video cameras and purchases. Now, some of the departments have asked for expansions in that area, which they will have to take up with the General Assembly on the new laws that are coming down. The good thing about North Carolina is, when I say that, the good thing about North Carolina is that many things are done on a knee-jerk reaction. That's exactly what happened across the country with these body-worn cameras. The situation that developing here is that we're discussing what they need to put in the rules and the laws in order to make a good decision for the state law enforcement and other people that's going to be involved. The maximum grant per agency was $100,000, and we've not had, that sounds like a lot of money, but when you talk about Mecklenburg County alone, between $8 and $10 million, $8 and $11 million actually, then you look at it from the standpoint of what's available and what we have money for. The Burns JAG grants also are available for North Carolina. This year we received $4.6 million. And is the money for 15-16, 100% federal money, no required matching funds. And the money from JAG grant can be used for body cameras also. Over $25 million in requests have been made to the Governor's Crime Commission. We only have 4.6 to allocate, if that gives you an idea of where we come from. These are some of the cities that and counties that has the applications in place now. Of course, you can see some of them small, some of them large. Town of Duck, Dunn, and then you got, of course, larger departments, City of Concord and Lexington, and now Red Springs is a small area also. But Rocky Mount is using the cameras, is going to be using the cameras for a lot of things. The Sheriff's Department has been involved in the body-worn cameras there. So you can see the town that's put in so far. The for 16-17 cameras, you see the ones that's put in so far, Forest City, Marion, Huntersville, Wingate, Fayetteville, Leland, Gardner, and Dobson. There again, we have some larger departments like Fayetteville and the Chiefs here today to make some remarks in regards to pros and cons for the body-worn cameras there. The just some general information, and I know we've got a lot of speakers and a short period of time, but I just wanted to give you some information about what we had at this point. 30 police and sheriff's departments have opened body-worn camera grants. prior to receiving the state appropriations through local law enforcement block grants and statewide infrastructure and technology improvement initiatives. These were set to end on June of 2016, when state appropriations could begin. Some of the counties, here again, large, small, Avery, Columbus, Edgecombe, Madison, Martin, New Hanover. So we have small counties, large counties, within large cities within those counties. Of course, Wilmington and New Hanover. And then we have counties that are not isolated, but they're not in particular areas of accumulation. Sheriff from Watauga County, matter of fact, is here today. And that's a prime example, because they're having problems up there now just with the lack of fuel when it snows. So there's a lot of things that the cameras can do with a whole lot more than what we have. 20 agencies have applied for 15-16, and the state appropriation for the body-worn cameras have been applied for by several of the towns already. Concord, Duck, Dunn, Biltmore Forest, Matthews, Elkin, and counties and cities within those counties, Mecklenburg, Pearson, Wilkes, Cleveland. The other thing is most projects include the number of cameras needed per agency, power supplies, connectors, and cable equipment for the cameras. 10 agencies so far have applied for the 16-17 state appropriations, and just to give you an idea, Burlington, Gardner, Fayetteville, Marion, Forest City, and Huntersville. Appropriations so far for the total budget applications is $1.26 million. That's the folks that have asked for the units that's been put in the database for approval. Here again, I'm sure the chiefs and the sheriffs and Eddie and some of the other folks that are here representing the sheriffs can give you pros and cons of what we've had. What we've heard so far is that the storage is going to be a problem, because the larger departments, they can do it and to a certain extent, the Mecklenburgs, the Guilfords, the Forsythes. But when you got a small department, they're not going to be able to afford it. And so they've got to work on a regional concept or another concept that would work in together with storage and retrieval of the situation. Also, the liability factor that's involved. Eddie and I were in Washington for the national conference this past week, and we heard stories about an individual that was somebody had called in on domestic violence. The guys got there, made the arrest, put the person in custody, went to court. The man and woman, like many times, come walking in holding hands, and the woman was wanting to sue the officer because they didn't get a waiver so that she could get, they could show her picture in court. And so there's a lot of liability issues that we're going to have to look at and look at very strongly. And I'd like to call on Chief Tom Atkins from the City of Hickory just for a couple minutes to give you short information based on a middle-sized department, and then call the chief from Fayetteville to talk about a situation and the problem that you'd have in a larger department. I'm sorry.
Come on up, Chief. We'll fit you in. Come on up.
Okay.
Introduce yourself to the group. We'll give you about 3 minutes.
Yes, sir.
My name is Tom Atkins. I'm the Chief of Police with the City of Hickory. The police department of the Hickory is about 100, well, it's, we're authorized 117 officers. Unfortunately, we don't have those fully filled all the time, so it varies between 100 and 117. The police department of Hickory started researching body-worn cameras in 2013. In early 2014, we started to field test those units. In May of 2014, we signed a contract with a vendor to purchase 90 body cameras, which is about the size of our patrol division, for all uniform officers when they're working on the street. To give you an idea of the first year cost for that contract, for a 5-year contract, the upfront cost the first year was $97,368.50. That gave us hardware, software, and a data storage plan. Now, the data storage plan was not a unlimited. It was a cap of a certain amount of data that we could use. As we started in our first year, we found out that we have our retention plan set up where there were certain categories that we keep it for 60 days, some we keep for longer. It just all depended on the circumstance. We quickly found out that, just like a data plan and a phone, that you can get the phone pretty cheap, but the data plan, when you go over it, you're going to have to start paying extra costs. So we found ourselves paying extra cost, or potentially paying extra cost for our data storage in the cloud. In 2000, this fiscal year, 15-16, we used some of the JAG grant money that we received from the federal government, and also some of our money that from local funds, and we purchased an additional 25 cameras, so that gave us 115 cameras. But also during that time, we expanded our data storage plan to unlimited. That cost, first year adjustment, was $105,840 to store our data for the rest of that contract, which will end in fiscal year June of 2019. This data storage plan we have is in the cloud. We are able to share our video via a link with our district attorney's office, and then the data can be shared with the defense attorney if the DA so chooses to share that particular video. It also has a evidence tag every time that video is reviewed by an officer, by a supervisor, by anyone in the department that has access to that particular video. It'll stamp that it was viewed by that person. Also, that link shared to the district attorney, and if that district attorney shares it with a defense attorney, that is categorized with that particular video. There's only certain protocols that will allow individuals to download that video. So all through this policy, all through this implementation, we start out with a policy and then adjust our policy as we found ourselves in certain situations. But that's sort of our way we implemented it since 2013. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chief. Appreciate it.
I made a grave error. I've got to correct it here. I didn't introduce our sergeant at arms, and I should have done that. Ed Kessler? Where is Ed? He's out in the hall. Wave to him when you go by. Matt Urban? He's out in the hall. Warren Hawkins and Doug Harris and one more.
David Layton.
Okay. We're going to now go to some local law enforcement agencies that are going to sort of give us a feel for where they are, and much like the chief just did, what problems they've run into and so forth. We have about 10 minutes for each of these speakers, so if you will, put all you can into that 10 minutes. If we end up with more time afterward, we'll take more time. First is Sergeant Judd. Yes.
Are you have questions at the end of everything?
Yes. Well, I'm sorry, I didn't ask for questions on this one. Do you have questions about Director Huffman? Are you still here? There he is. Did you have a question?
Yeah, Hickory. Just now. Yeah, in terms of, you didn't mention, I thought we were looking for, you didn't mention any particular barriers because we know it's limited to money and all, but you didn't mention any.
Well, I think the barrier that we ran into is, one, is finding the money through our general fund and continuing that money through our funding. What we end up doing is we had to suspend our in the dash camera video and then went to the body camera. Obviously, the body camera is only the officer. They can see a similar type thing, but we had to stop and suspend our dash cam. So what we have now is everybody in body cameras, but dash cam moving forward since 2013 is not there.
And we'll hear more from some of the other speakers. Sergeant Justin Flint from the Greensboro Police Department. After him, we'll have Major Willis from the Charlotte Department. Sergeant
Sergeant Justin Flint with Greensboro Police Department. I'm going to talk real fast so I can get 30 minutes of information in my 10-minute speech here. A quick version of where we are. We're about 2.5 years into a full rollout of body-worn cameras for our patrol bureau. We have approximately 700 sworn officers, and about 500 of those on a given day wear their body-worn cameras. We're doing that with about 340 cameras. The patrol bureau is actually sharing cameras. The days they're off, somebody else is wearing the same camera. So a lot of our hurdles revolve around equipment issues that's vendor-specific, and I don't think necessary for this venue. So I'm going to skip into what about the video. That tends to be where we're looking to the legislator to give us some answers. There's been a lot of questions in the 2.5 years we've had this program about release of video, who can see it, what's protected, what isn't protected. So that's kind of where we're headed with this. The three main questions that I kind of want to talk about in my 10-minute speech here is, how long should video be maintained by the agency? What's a standard that's acceptable for everybody? I heard some cost conversations a minute ago, and I think that's been a big discussion when we've met with the CEGIN board and talked about body-worn cameras, is the cost grows astronomically the longer you're in the body-worn camera business because you're storing more and more data unless you have retention plans. The next thing would be, which videos are not protected from public release, either by laws concerning evidence or laws concerning personnel files? And then the last thing I'm going to hit at the end of this is, are there any additional privacy concerns for the citizens that are captured on the video or the private locations in which some videos are captured? How we deal with our current retention and our policy is, we have five categories that all video falls into one of those five categories, and then two additional categories that are tagged on as internal things. Each body-worn category is associated with their retention time period, and that's governed right now in our policy by Standard 9 of the Records Retention and Disposition Schedule for Municipalities. Within there, that was one of the things that was mentioned earlier, that there was an adoption or a change from in-car cameras to include mobile digital video and the minimum 30-day retention unless it was tagged onto a case file. Once it is tagged to a misdemeanor case file, you're at 3 years, and a felony case file, you're at 20 years. So our retention categories mirror that. We also like the retention policy because it's really the only way we can manage our data storage, which then gets into budgetary predictions and being able to sustain a body-worn camera program for longer than your initial startup year. These are our retention categories. You'll see that the five main ones, that every video must fall within one of these categories. Citizens contact non-criminal is 90 days, criminal investigation 3 years, vehicle stop or crash where something less than a misdemeanor charge was made, 90 days, anything misdemeanor or greater resulting in a vehicle stop or crash, 3 years, and then non-citizen involvement videos are 90 days. That doesn't speak to the 20 years. This is just our retention policy within the cloud storage. Anything that is a felony charge, we capture within our records management system on a local server at the department, and it's maintained indefinitely. Our definition of this, I'll breeze through these real quick, not to waste our 10 minutes here. Video of an interaction with a citizen that is not part of a criminal investigation, nor does the interaction result in a criminal charge. That's our definition of citizen contact non-criminal. We also have any criminal investigation, video of an interaction or otherwise evidentiary value to any case that has resulted in or could result in a criminal charge. We're keeping those on our cloud storage through our vendor for 3 years. Again, vehicle stops, warning or infraction, or anything that doesn't result in a charge being made of misdemeanor greater, we're only keeping for 90 days. It was mentioned earlier, 30 days is the minimum within the retention standard 9. But we chose 90 days at our agency so that we could accommodate any complaints that might come in and have the video available. We felt 30 days might be a too small of a window to capture all the complaints that are out there. Criminal charges that come off of a vehicle stop or crash, 3 years. And then non-citizen involvement, just that video that doesn't contain a contact or interaction between an officer and a citizen, we're keeping that for 90 days. That could be driving emergency traffic to a call and being canceled en route. Our policy requires them to video they're driving emergency traffic, so we'll keep that for 90 days. No complaints come in. The video is purged off of our cloud storage. We require the officers to put this in our records management system so that we can maintain it beyond 3 years for felony cases. And then we add two additional categories, field training video and administrative investigations, that get added supplementally to one of the other five categories that help us enhance the retention of that based on the needs. The considerations around a retention policy, things that kind of came to mind when I thought we had the opportunity to come here and speak to the subcommittee, is depending on the required retention time periods for video,
what costs are expected to be incurred by the agencies. And you've got a department of probably 1,200 going to speak here in a minute. Ours is about 700 sworn. We heard Hickory speak about 120 officers. Everybody's cost is going to be different, so it's hard to just put a dollar sign on it. But what we've all seen that have implemented this for a year or more is that the cost is very great in proportion to your budget. It's become a large thing to sustain this program and keep these videos. The cameras are cheap. Putting them on the officers, not that hard to do. Maintaining the videos for a period of time that matches with the current retention schedule is tending to be expensive. Can the cost of video storage make sustaining a BWC program cost prohibitive to agencies? I think it could, depending on your budget and where your needs are. It might be that sustaining video that you're keeping for 20 years just isn't where your priorities are with a limited budget. Could statewide video repository or some kind of statewide cloud-based storage system provide us with a uniform and affordable way for all agencies to maintain their videos consistently for a predetermined period of time? And if we did this, would this also facilitate direct access to videos by the state court system that was mentioned from Hickory about sharing through links with the court system? In the county that we work in, they have their own evidence.com account because the vendor we use provided them a free account, they being the court system. We share a case, which includes all the videos related to that case, through evidence.com. So even if we purge the case at 3 years, but it's attached to something that's still working its way through the appeals process, those videos, once they're transferred or shared in a case to the court system, now take on the court system's defined retention policy, and we as an agency can still purge them at the appropriate time period. So we're not retaining videos for their need. That's great, but if we change vendors, we possibly lose that feature because that's something specific to the vendor we're using right now. A statewide repository or statewide cloud-based system where it's owned by the government and the court system would have direct access to things that law enforcement's putting in might facilitate that without it being vendor-specific. So just some things for consideration on that. Just because a video was captured in the course of an agency responding to a particular situation, now the question is all of that video really discoverable or really considered evidence in the case that any criminal charges were made? And that tends to be a big thing with data retention, is we're retaining everything if any criminal charge was made. Any video that was made related to that response gets retained because the DA's office is adamant that that's discoverable, and they don't want to be found to be in violation of discovery laws by us purging a response to a call. That officer might not have made it on scene or made it on scene and never talked to any citizen or anybody involved in the investigation, only talked to another officer to relieve them on a traffic post, but their video is attached to that call. The DA's office is deeming it discoverable. We now have to maintain it for up to 20 years for felony charges and 3 years for misdemeanors. It just becomes expensive. We might need some definition of body-worn cameras aren't the same thing as the crime scene video or the crime scene picture's specific evidentiary value. Another consideration related to the retention policy, if the officers are involved in directing traffic around the scene or providing crime scene security again, would their video be evidence? Would their video be discoverable? If it's deemed discoverable but not evidence, could we find some way to regulate a separate retention policy where we're not maintaining video that's not actually pertinent and probably will never get introduced into evidence in the court just because it's deemed discoverable? There's different types of video to the second point of this when I had three questions at the beginning. And I think the biggest question is which videos are statutorily protected and which ones could be released, should be released, may be released, depending on which verbiage you put in a policy. And when looking at this, just comes to mind, there's four obvious categories. There's probably more than that. I know when we bounced the idea around at the Siegen board meetings, you could probably break this up into maybe six or seven categories and have different rules for each category. But you obviously have video that could be introduced as evidence in a criminal case. Then the video that might be discoverable because it was part of a response but doesn't have any evidentiary value. You have video that's directly related to and attached to or included in an employee's personnel file, something that is specific video attached to a complaint investigation or specific video attached to a performance evaluation tool, not just the fact that we recorded video and I gave the supervisor a chance to review the video and use that review for the performance evaluation, which just means specifically attached videos. And then also video that doesn't fall within any of those first three categories. And I think when you're looking at which ones are statutorily protected, we need some guidance and some clear definition on which video that's body-worn camera-specific video is things we need to maintain and not release to the public, and which ones we may release or which ones we will release. The third issue that was listed there is about other privacy concerns. Bouncing this idea around when we've talked to other agencies that have already employed cameras, trying to figure out if we go down the road of releasing data, we decide something's not protected either as criminal evidence or not protected as a personnel file, the question becomes, are we still trying to release all the video, or is there some video that's protected by the person that's on its privacy rights? I got a quick video here just to illustrate this point. It's got a few little things in here I'll read just in case the screen's too small. I say I've got a video that plays. So body-worn cameras, is all video suited for public consumption, or is there some video that is obviously protected by the person's rights that are captured on the video? You've got the officer responding to the call, pull up in front of the house, they get out. Obviously, this is no different than the dash cameras when we're talking about other people's privacy rights. We'll get into some DCI issues in a second, but you're in a public space taking the video that's occurring in a public place. Get on the curtilage of somebody's property, is there any significant difference when we capture video that's within somebody's Fourth Amendment protected area, the curtilage of their own private property, versus when we're standing in a public place? At what point does a video become protected by a citizen's right to privacy, even if not statutorily protected either by General Statute 132.1 for evidence in criminal cases or 168 related to employees' personnel files? Now we're inside somebody's house. I think this is where we need to take a minute to realize that all the previous in-car cameras that we had, all law enforcement cameras before, were normally taking video in a public place, capturing things that occurred in a public place, whereas body-worn cameras take us into places that we haven't been before on camera. So, question to the group is, can new legislation specific to body-worn cameras protect individuals' rights about and concerns about their privacy? So if we're going to publicly release video, if we decide that we may release it or we shall release it, and it's video that's not statutorily protected, and it was captured in a public place, then what logistical and financial implications will this have for different agencies? Do we need somebody that's going to review every minute of the video, the first 30 seconds of the video, the first and last 30 seconds of the video, to make sure that the video in its entirety was captured in a public place, not in somebody's Fourth Amendment protected area? And then what method of medium or media should we use to facilitate the video release? I think both of these, again, play into the cost of being able to sustain a body-worn camera program. I think that a lot of agencies would like to release appropriate video at a time that is appropriate and benefits the transparency between the department and the community. But first, we've got to figure out, what should we release? Is it really something that was taken in a public space? And then how do we release it? What checks and balances do we need to have in place, i.e. the review of the video? And then how do we fund it? That's probably going to be as expensive as the initial upstart of buying equipment and storing data, is if we've got a lot of man hours involved in reviewing video, or we outsource it to a third party with some fancy software that's very expensive to use. Again, is there such an extreme cost associated with the review of video prior to release as compared to the initial an annual equipment cost of equipment storage, and if so, what or who might fund the portion of the body-worn camera program? One of the things that we've bounced around in our office when we talk about it'd be nice to get to a point where we could release videos to the public that are appropriate is, who should we release the videos to? Should it only be people that have a direct interest in the video? Is all video that's not statutorily protected automatically available to any member of the public? Or should we restrict it to someone that is specifically captured in the video, or their parent or guardian or their legal counsel, or somebody that is the owner of the private place in which the video was captured? So we've kind of bounced that around to say, is it just because it's available for release, is everybody really entitled to it, or is there privacy concerns of the citizens we serve in which we should limit who we show this to? How'd I do for cramming that into 10 minutes?
Good.
Hit it right on the nut.
All right, any questions?
I have one.
Yes, sir.
Sergeant Flint, I appreciate the presentation, but I guess having seen you twice before at Siegen, I know this, and maybe some. This retention schedule that you just talked about, this is new to Greensboro, right?
Yes, sir.
Like within this week?
Yes, sir. You want me to give a quick explanation of how we got there?
Yes. You got there and what your retention schedule was before you changed this week?
We initially had it when we first started this program. Everything got maintained for 6 months and then purged if it wasn't uploaded into our records management or our IA Pro system. We went away from that almost 2 years ago and decided let's try to keep every video we've ever made, and then we've got it if somebody asked for it. Our contract was for 27.5 terabytes of data. Within about 18 months, we saw it rise to approximately 38 terabytes of data, well over what we were paying for. Our vendor was nice to us. They didn't charge us for it because we were coming up on contract renewal. We decided to go ahead and mitigate that. We went to a retention policy that we modeled very closely to something I'd seen Charlotte use at the Siegen meeting, and that was the same one I went through in my presentation a minute ago. And once we implemented that, we got down to 17 terabytes of data, still within our contract, and still gives us a little room to video more things and keep them for that retention period.
Other questions from committee? Sergeant, thank you so much. Technology in the Greensboro Police Department has changed since I was there, and we had to walk two blocks to a call box in order to talk to somebody. Major Stephen Willis of the Charlotte Mecklenburg Police Department. Major, glad to have you with us. Appreciate you coming.
Thank you, sir.
You can have the same 10 minutes as Sergeant has.
The same 10 minutes. I don't know if I can cram it as fast as he did. Let's see. Good afternoon, and thank you for having me. So quickly, again, in 10 minutes' time, we'll talk briefly about Charlotte's policy, how we came about cameras, where we are today, and kind of where we would like to go in the future. So just some background. In March of 2015, we finalized a contract with our vendor, Taser. That contract total to Taser was $5.4 million over 5 years, so essentially $1 million a year. That purchased us 1,400 cameras, some additional components there, a CAD integration that allows us to populate case numbers to our videos automatically. There was an additional $2 million of ancillary costs that did not go to Taser that dealt with construction and a few other items. So the total contract for the city was $7.1 million for that 5 years. We did that in two phases of implementation. Phase one, March of 15 through September of 15. We deployed a little over 1,100 cameras to 17 different patrol-based divisions. Those officers are on the front lines answering calls for service on a regular basis. Phase two, September of 15 through February of 16, was our CAD integration that allows the CAD system to automatically populate the case number to the particular video that the officer recorded, saving the officer a few minutes of time in the field. And then we're currently going through the signal deployment for triggered recording. Specifically to our cars, we're installing equipment in the cars that will automatically start the recording of every camera within 30 feet of a car every time the blue lights are turned on and every time the siren is activated. Sometime later in this process, probably later in this year, we'll also do the same type of triggering every time a taser is activated. It will start the recording of every camera within 30 feet of that taser. And then phase three, currently under evaluation, and that is seeking the money to outfit additional officers with body-worn cameras. Currently, we just do it with patrol, and we currently just do it in an on-duty capacity. So the officers working in off-duty, I'm sure you all saw what happened in Charlotte on Christmas Eve. That officer was working in an off-duty capacity and was not wearing a camera. Our storage is based through evidence.com, very similar to Greensboro. It is a hosted solution. It's cloud-based. It is CJIS compliant. We currently have a 45-day standard retention. Lacking any other direction, we went with the retention schedule that is associated with in-car cameras. In-car camera retention schedule says that you must keep that video for at least 30 days. We were keeping it for 90 days prior to implementation of body-worn cameras, and we have changed both of our systems to a 45-day base retention schedule. Video not marked for longer-term retention, as I said, or a personnel matter will be deleted on that after that 45th day. It is deleted, again, after 45 days. Digital evidence management. When we went forward with a purchase or a contract with Taser, our direction was is that in year one, we would pay for cloud-based storage solution. We were already in the process of developing a digital evidence management system to maintain our digital crime scene photography. So our plan was in year two, three, four, and five to offload our video from that cloud-based storage solution, anything that we were going to keep for longer than 30 or 45 days, just like Greensboro does for their felonies, we were going to offload it to local storage to save us that approximate $1 million a year in additional storage costs. It's about $1.65 per gig per month per officer to store video under our current contract. Each officer records about 3 hours per shift, and every hour of video is 1 gigabyte. So I'll let you smart people do the math. It's extremely expensive when you look at a cloud-based storage solution in the amount of video that agencies our size and even Greensboro's size begin to start storing video. Just like Greensboro talked about our retention schedule, we developed a 45-day base, and as you can see, non-citizen involvement 45 days, traffic stops 45 days for warnings and infractions. Misdemeanors associated with traffic stops or misdemeanor investigations we keep for 3 years. Traffic stops that result in felony arrests or criminal investigations that are associated with felonies, we mark those and keep those for 20 years. Non-criminal offenses, similar to the domestic violence that was referenced earlier, if we get there and there's no crime, we've made contacts with citizens, a complaint could be generated out of that particular call for service, so we're going to keep it for at least 45 days and then let it be deleted. IACMS is our internal affairs case management system, and we will maintain that video for 4 years. And anything higher than the 3 year or the 45 day, if we add IACMS to any video, if it's 45 days originally by the officer, it trumps it and we keep it for 4 years. Could be a complaint, could be a use of force investigation, an accident, an injury, something that we would internally administratively investigate, we would keep for 4 years. So the next few slides are very similar to what was talked about earlier. Standard 9, this talks about mobile video unit tapes. It talks about that anything from an in-car solution you must keep for 30 days. At a minimum, most agencies keep it for longer. As you heard, Greensboro keeps it for 90 days. Again, Standard 9, case history file felonies and case history file misdemeanors. The challenge becomes that if it's not evidence, if it's not something you're going to take to court that shows the suspect doing something, or it's not illustrative of physical evidence on the scene, the absence of that is it's a record. It's no different than a case report that the police officer wrote. Therefore, it falls into record retention standard, and we have to keep it for 20 years or 3 years, depending upon whether or not it's a felony or a misdemeanor. And again, this talks about citizen complaints, again, in Standard 9, and internal affairs case files, how long we have to keep those. And those are internal, and we keep those for a minimum of 4, just because the standard for litigation is 3 years. We keep it for 1 year past that in order to protect ourselves with the data. And then, of course, personnel records is associated there, and it talks about how long we have to keep it. I mean, it even references 30 days for or 30 years for certain records. Obviously, that's not this. So. Let's talk quickly about the public accessibility in our in-car camera system. And so there will be two schools of thought as you hear me talk through this. One of them is in line with House Bill 713, if we have to go down that path with legislation, absent anything else. Under 160A-168, and there was a handout for that, it's in-car video was interpreted to be part of an employee's personnel file for law enforcement officers. To the extent that the General Assembly awarded Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department or the City of Charlotte an exemption in 1997 that allowed us to provide access to in-car video to citizens. And it was those citizens who had a complaint. Those people who were involved in that particular situation had the ability to sit down with us and watch it. We didn't give them a copy of it. We didn't give it to the media. It was specific to the individuals that were associated with that call for service or that traffic stop. So we were awarded that exemption, and that exemption is provided in the handouts that came today. So body-worn video is very similar to what we did in 1997. For us, it's not reinventing the wheel. We just had the lack of terminology, because if you actually read that exemption from 1997, unfortunately, the technology at the time, nobody anticipated we would be talking body cameras now. That wording specifically says video from an in-car camera. Therefore, we could not apply that to our body cameras without being subjected to a misdemeanor. I've only got 18 months left, and I don't want to get locked up between now and 18 months. So we don't think it's reinventing the wheel. We think it's very simple that if we go down that path of personnel record, from a transparency standpoint, the people that we need to be transparent to are the aggrieved citizen. We don't need to be transparent to everyone. We need to be transparent to that aggrieved citizen. So we simply can provide access to that video to that aggrieved citizen, sit down, allow them to watch that video outside a court proceeding. If it is a court proceeding, there are laws in place that allow the defendants access to video as a part of the discovery packet. So that's one school of thought. As we went down that path, lack of any other legislation, lack of any other direction, that was the path in which we chose and we have developed our policy here. So again, body-worn camera video, 168-168, it's currently interpreted to be part of the employee's personnel file. We don't have a current exemption for that, therefore we do not release that video under any circumstance. So some of our recommendations, and these recommendations are the second school of thought, and they fit right in with House Bill 713 with just a couple of changes, and that really revolves around the words of release as opposed to access or to the ability to see it. So as you'll see this talks specifically to what you see in House Bill 713. Again, this talks to that with just a couple of changes, and if you see there, the very first part, a person alleged to have been aggrieved by an officer's actions who is seeking to listen to audio and or watch video recorded from a law enforcement officer's body-worn or in-car camera must state the date, talked about reasonable particularity, etc. And there at the bottom, it changes. One recommendation of change is a law enforcement agent may allow the review of such audio or video records without the consent of the employees whose actions are depicted on such records, as opposed to release. The challenge is just as Justin talked about, is if we release this video, there are innocent victims in that video. If we release it, it's going to end up on YouTube, it's going to end up on national television, local television, and those innocent victims in the background are going to be the ones that are going to be ultimately victimized by the release of that video. And then this just talks about the rationale behind the amendments. The First Amendment would make it clear that audio video that otherwise qualifies as records of criminal investigations is treated as other criminal investigatory material. Such material could but is not required to be released or shown to certain individuals. And then the second portion of the amendment recognizes that some audio video would not qualify as that record, but to avoid the burden of sweeping requests that could paralyze a law enforcement agency, requests could be relatively specific. Now, I'll just give you an example of paralyzing a law enforcement agency. Justin talked about the amount of video that they have over a two-year period. We've been implemented since April. I'm currently at 11 terabytes. We add about a terabyte a month, and we delete about a terabyte a month. So we've kind of come to the position of planing out, but fortunately, crime's not up here. Crime's right here. As crime increases, the amount of video that we're going to record is going to increase because we're going to respond to more calls for service. We're going to be in a position to record more video. So as you can see, that ebb and flow, you can't tie it to dollar and cents 100% of the time. So there are going to be some agencies, such as Hickory, as the chief mentioned, are going to be in that position where we estimated what our cost was going to be, but things change, things happen, officers recorded. It's not bright line. It's not automatic. Some officers are going to record more. Some officers are going to record less. So you're in a position of a very flexible budget. And you hope that you've estimated high enough and have enough money in your budget to be able to handle that ongoing cost. Because most agencies, mid-size or smaller, don't have the IT staff to maintain their own storage. They end up having to find some other third party, and they have to pay them money as well. We're fortunate enough that we do have staff on board to help maintain some of that. But again, that still becomes very expensive. And that's all I have.
Questions of the mayor? Senator?
Yes,
Senator
just a
Robin.
Couple of questions.
Yes, ma'am.
To you and or the Greensboro officer too. You have different bases for retention of videos. Is there any baseline for you to develop retention periods?
Yes,
some
ma'am.
Some are similar, some are different, and I heard that federal standards, so how do you do that?
We base it on Standard 9 in the record retention rules for the state. That the archive sets for records of the state, that the minimum is 30, days, for an example. And most agencies don't go with the minimum. Most agencies will give themselves that buffer. That's why we go 15 days beyond that. We give ourselves that 45-day buffer. The 3 years and the 20 years are pretty bright line. I don't want to go past 20 years because that's a long time to hang on to video. And we investigate, unfortunately, a lot of felonies in Charlotte-Mecklenburg. So that's a lot of video that we have to keep for a long period of time.
Okay. The other question is in terms of comparability in terms of design. I heard you say something about when you initiate a taser, then your camera automatically comes up. What about standards in terms of, and I heard some differences here, for design? What about standards for design?
Yes, ma'am.
Where do you get those from? And do you have a committee that's working on that? And who's on that?
There are a number of vendors that are out there. Body-worn cameras is the new technological project to make money on. There are a number of vendors out there, all the way down to a GoPro, that are proposing that their video cameras can be used for law enforcement purposes. The challenge is each vendor develops their own particular product. They patent that, and you're kind of stuck with that vendor. A lot of times it's price-driven. You can get what you can afford. So unless the state or a city or a county sets a particular standard of what they want their agencies to have, it's pretty open. And I think if you were to poll the agencies in the room, you're going to see an array of different vendors. I know there's several of us that have the same vendor, but there is, and even nationwide, I mean, I will say we've participated in all of those presidential committees and COPS office studies and toolkits and everything else. We've participated in all of those and provided input on all of those. But again, it's cost is going to be your driver as to what you get.
Other questions in the major?
Yeah, I have one.
Yes, sir.
As far as funding goes, now Charlotte-Mecklenburg, are y'all funding all this internally with local money, or are you getting any grants?
We were awarded, if you want to call it a grant, we were awarded one grant from the Lee Foundation. It was more of a donation than it was a grant. And then our police foundation awarded us $250,000. The remainder of that money came from the coffers of the city.
Representative Hurley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. From what I'm hearing, you all don't keep the cameras on all the time. How do you decide when to turn them on?
Yes, ma'am. So one of the things that Charlotte did is our policy and our intention behind implementing body-worn cameras is to monitor the interaction that our officers have with the public. We did not implement our cameras to capture evidence. We have crime scene technicians that can take pictures of evidence. We have officers who are credible, who can testify with their credibility as to what they saw. We use them to monitor that interaction. Therefore, an officer is required to, in our policy, it outlines specific types of events in which they must activate their camera, and they will continue to record until their posture changes to an investigative-based posture. So I'll just give you a prime example. They might respond to a rape in progress call, and when they arrive, the only thing that they find is a victim and a crime scene. Once they arrive on that scene and they're beginning their process of investigating and interviewing that victim, they will stop recording. Because the challenge runs into is if it's a four-hour investigation, I'm now keeping 4 hours of video for 20 years. Because it's considered part of a felony investigation. Whereas if I keep 30 minutes of his response and his arrival and his contact with the victim, I'm now only keeping 30 minutes of video for 4 years. So it really is a cost decision, but it is also designed around the intent is to capture the interaction, those adversarial interactions that are usually going to generate a use of force or a complaint.
Sergeant, could you respond to that?
We have a real similar policy to Charlotte. I think some of their when they should turn it on mirrored some of ours, as we've been in the business just a little bit longer than they had. We recently had proposed a revision to our policy. As recent as this morning, we were meeting with our entire command staff. It's still in draft form. You should have a copy of it as a handout to my PowerPoint presentation of our draft policy. And it's very specific with a lot of turn them on all these types of calls. And what we're recommending the change to be is to say, turn it off at the conclusion of the call, not to include the time you spend in your car typing reports, but once you're done talking to the people at the house and you leave, turn your camera off. We used to have it written exactly like Charlotte said, whereas deemed investigative, we could turn it off, or we still have written that way, excuse me, the draft policy just doesn't recommend that. The problem we found is that we are wanting to use these for transparency with the community that we serve, and it's hard to be completely transparent, or seem to be completely transparent, if I've got a 30-minute interaction with a citizen, and only 2 to 5 minutes of that is on video, because the officer deemed that it became investigative, and then later on some comment was made that somebody feels wasn't appropriate, and they want to see the video to see, you know, what happened. We would like to be able to be transparent for the whole call. But when we do that, now we're looking at data storage again, we're right back into this kind of a evolving cycle of what do we do with the video. We want to keep more, but it's going to cost us to do that.
Thank you, Sergeant. Major, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Appreciate it. We now have, let's get moved to the county level. We have Sheriff Charles McDonald of Henderson County. Sheriff, good to have you with us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm just going to be just a few minutes. I'm kind of, how many of you remember the picture years ago with all the lemmings running to the edge of the cliff, pouring off, and the one guy standing there with a sign going, it doesn't end good, don't do this. I'm your lemming. Good afternoon. It's obvious. I've really learned a lot sitting here today. I think my few minutes that I'm going to spend would be asking that the subcommittee, wherever they move forward in this, don't legislate the use of body cameras or the implementation of body cameras or even how they're going to be used from the state level. I just don't think that's the right thing to do. All municipal law enforcement and certainly sheriff's offices in this nation were created to be autonomous, basically of and for and by the people. You know, the voters in my county are the ones who hold me accountable. If they don't like the job I do, they put me out of office. I'm familiar with video cams, used them a lot for different things, but one thing I think that we've kind of succumbed to across this nation is the belief in a false narrative that there's something wrong with law enforcement and that we're doing things that we're not doing. I've been in law enforcement 30 years, and I can see around here that a lot of you have been in about as long as I have and maybe more. And I can tell you across the board, I can't prove it, but across the board, stats will prove it, that we're more professional than we've ever been before. We're more trained on use of force. We're more public service oriented. And personally, I don't see the problem that's put us in a position where we're spending money that we don't even have in this state. I don't know if the states maybe found the same kind of money generator that the federal government's found, but you know, to me, we could take so much less money and spend it on training and spend it on, again, relational programs with law enforcement within these communities. I'm not trying to change anybody else's mind. If you're committed to doing that, that's fine. Henderson County will not do it unless we're somehow mandated to have to do that. But I would just ask this subcommittee to just really do keep in mind the autonomous nature of local law enforcement. I don't need the federal government or the state government keeping me on task. I have my citizens to do it, and if they're happy, they reelect me. We have very few problems, and I look at the myriads of legal issues and archiving issues, and I tell you who's going to make money on this whole venture, and we're not going to guarantee anything because there are no guarantees in our line of business, but it's going to be the people that archive, and it's going to be the people that write and make the laws. It's going to be challenged from here on out. This, get used to it. You're going to be challenged on it. And the one time a camera doesn't work or the one time you think that you shouldn't have to turn it over, where's your transparency again? You're going to be accused of doing the very thing that this run off the cliff is trying to avert. So that's my couple of cents for it, sir. I sure appreciate it. Appreciate everybody else, and thank you for those few minutes. If there's any questions, I'll be glad to answer.
Any questions of the sheriff? As you can see, there are two schools of thought, at least. At least. Thank you, Sheriff. Appreciate it. Sheriff Van Duncan of Buncombe County is with us, I believe.
Good to have you with us, Sheriff.
Good to be here, Chairman. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I first want to start by thanking the subcommittee and the fact that you're hearing from us today, the field users and some of us who have learned through experience. I'm not going to be real repetitive. We've been using body cams for about a year in Buncombe County. We started looking at the program and the worthwhile portions of the program in 2014, and we put it into effect in 15, and we've learned some very valuable lessons. One of the first things that we learned that I didn't necessarily believe that the vendors touted is it cuts down on your complaints overall. And for Buncombe County, it has, probably somewhere in the neighborhood of about 70%. And that was a really good thing, and we felt very much behind our body cam program and still do. About 3 weeks ago, I had an issue some of you may have read about or some of you may have not, that we had two officers that I had to terminate their employment after reviewing body cam footage. Now, what I can tell you from a law enforcement administrator, I'm very glad I had that footage because I'm not sure I would have made the same decision without it, and I feel very clear that I made the right decision with it. And then we get into all the myriad of what's protected, what should be released, what must be released. And I think really I'm going to kind of boil it down to what I see is the issues that I feel the subcommittee are really going to face when asked to advise the legislature around statutes involving body cams. And that's who gets the footage and when. Some of the things that we have learned that even though you've heard the old saying, no good deed goes unpunished, and we put body cameras on voluntarily, we paid for it through federal seizure forfeiture sharing money. Our policies are very much in line with best practice, much of what you've heard here today. We own our own server that is maintenance by county IT. We have 70 cameras in the field. So we can do that on a 10 terabyte server, and we have a pretty robust IT department in Buncombe County government. So they're able to keep that footage for us with the same controls and retention and everything that everybody else uses. Here are the issues that we've run into. Even though we had a situation that was filming in a person's house, that was a criminal investigation for a short period of time because those actions were reviewed by our district attorney on that body cam footage. The media beat our doors down for release of that footage. It was personnel. It was very much primary to the personnel investigation. But we were inundated with requests for release of that body cam footage. I think we've had 10 so far today because we had a community forum at the earlier part of this week, which kind of brought some attention back to it. So we've had 10 requests for that footage today, which is pretty much stopped by the law and by the interpretation of the Institute of Government right now. But here's where I worry. I believe in the body cams. They've been very beneficial and useful for us. But if North Carolina law starts to allow the release in any way as public information, we have just doubled the expense of our body cam program. Because what's going to happen, and I think what you've heard the departments before us talk about, is now we are going to have to watch every minute of body cam footage. It will have to be reviewed. And here's what I mean by that. I very much expect that if anything that's not already covered by North Carolina law is put in the realm of public information, Monday morning I will receive a request from my media outlets that says, we want your body cam footage that's not otherwise prevented by North Carolina law from Friday night to Sunday morning, which means we're going to have to review every minute of that body cam footage. What we do with one person now is probably going to be at least a couple of more, and the cost associated with it. So that's where I worry, and I do hear what Sheriff McDonald says about that. Once we start off that cliff, I'm a little afraid that we'll be able to pull it back. I think that everybody's concerned about accountability of law enforcement, and so am I, and I'm good with that. But what's been pointed out earlier, those systems are in place right now. We share our body cam footage, in other words, any complainant can view our body cam footage at any time. They can very easily get that through subpoena, or if they retain an attorney and want to take action against the law enforcement agency.
So that process is there for law enforcement to be held accountable. I'm not sure what the accountability process is in releasing all that to the media. We know there is some, but it's not very clear, and sometimes it's extremely messy and ugly, which leaves us with a lot of unintended consequences. But I really do appreciate y'all taking the time to hear from us and lessons learned, and I'm very appreciative of that. Got a tough job ahead of you, and I don't envy you. Thank you.
Questions of the sheriff, representative, excuse me, Senator Robinson.
Thank you, Sheriff Duncan. One question, you mentioned that any complainant could get access through subpoena, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes, ma'am.
It's probably costly or hard for some people. Wouldn't it be better served if your policy were similar to the exemption that Charlotte has?
Which exemption?
They've got the exemption from the General Assembly, which allowed for a person, a complainant. Where's your policy? Recite it again.
Yes, ma'am. It allows a complainant access to the video that their part allows them to come in and meet with you. We're not releasing it until we allow them to come in.
Ours is the same.
Okay, but you just said it had to be by subpoena, et cetera, et cetera.
No, ma'am, just to release the video. In other words, for us to make copy and turn that video out, anybody that complains can come in at any time and review that video with our internal affairs department.
Okay, well, my concern was the difficulty for a citizen, if they were the complainant, to be able to review it. So this is...
We actually encourage and welcome that. If someone has a complaint, come in and review their body cam footage if it exists.
Let me expand on that. I believe the term aggrieved was used. Is yours the same standard? An aggrieved person, somebody who's actually involved in some way.
Yes, sir. And we refer to it as anybody was standing or anybody involved in the call or who might have been captured on body cam footage. That individual would have the ability to come in and review that footage. And when I say exist, if it's a patrol call, it's going to exist. But if it's a civil process, school resource officer, and all the many functions that the sheriff serves, we do not have body cams on everyone in the field. We have 70.
Any other questions of the sheriff? Thank you so much. Yes, appreciate sir. Thank you. Quite interesting day, I think. We all learned something, and we all heard something we already knew. So we're in the midst of trying to take all these ingredients and bake some kind of a cake. We don't even know yet what the cake's supposed to look like. I do want to, particularly for members of the committee, sort of try to head us in a direction to give us a good conversation about this. And it seems to me that we are, of course, the first question is, should the state even get involved in this situation? I think all of us would agree, probably so. Then the question becomes, at what level? Now, when the bills that we talked about that are over in the Senate now were entered last year, the idea was leaning heavily on the state setting standards. And that was sort of the mindset. Now, since that time, we've all had a chance to talk about this, and I've had I don't know how many 100,000 calls, and I know all the legislators are hearing about this from their constituents and others. Now, a possibility is if there is a role for the state to play in setting some overall requirements having to do with records and so forth, but leave the functioning rules and procedures to the local governments, even to the point of, as the sheriff said, not even using body cameras if they so choose. So that at this point seems to be sort of the avenue we're going to take a turn down and begin to work in that regard. Now, we may find once we get deeper in it that the state's involvement should be larger than that. Primarily, I say that because of the dollar figures that are involved with all this that we're talking about. And that doesn't mean we've got the extra dollars at the state level. So those of you at home, don't get the wrong idea there. I saw the Highway Patrol cringe when I said that. So next time around, we're going to have two more meetings of the subcommittee. The next time around, we're going to talk a little bit about the state agencies and what they're doing and what their thinking is, as we have with local agencies here today. And we're also going to be inviting some other folks, like the DAs and what have you. And we want to get some interaction from some public voices and some media voices. So we'll be working toward that. And Representative McNeil will be chairing the next committee, the next subcommittee meeting. And I hope all of you will not only take advantage of going back and reviewing what we talked about here today, but encourage your folks back home that work alongside you to do the same thing. We want to get as much as we can possibly get our hands on to make the right decisions. And we're always here asking for information. Also, next time we want to hear from, we heard from the chiefs and the sheriffs individually today. Next time I'd like to also, if we can, Representative McNeil, like to have the Sheriff's Association, Eddie, Representative, and the Chiefs Association, Fred, to sort of give us the feel of the body of the associations. You can see already that within the group of sheriffs and within the group of chiefs, there are going to be differences of opinion. So it will help us to know what the principal opinion or feeling of those two associations might be. So I think we would look for that too. With that, are there any other questions?
Just one. I want to thank you and Representative McNeil for chairing this, because it is a very important subject, and about the inclusiveness of bringing people forward across the year. And as we get to presentations, I'd like to also know when the policies that are set at the various local levels, what the composition of those committees in terms of diversity, in terms of gender, as well. Have a local policy committee who's, you know, looking at best practices and set those policies. What's the diversity of those committees at the local level? They bring that information.
Let me do this. Sergeant, yes, in Greensboro, when you began your camera program from the standpoint of having rules and what have you, was that done completely within the department, within city government, or with outside citizenry participating?
I'm going to answer half of that for you, then I'm going to refer to our police attorney because he was involved in the process. I came after the fact, but it was done within the police department and involving our city legal staff. But as far as diversity of a committee, at that point in time, it wasn't a full committee making that particular policy. It was a few people who had, we'll call them subject matter experts. They knew a lot more about the program. Remember, this was 2.5 years ago before anybody was wearing in the state. We didn't have a lot of knowledge, so we didn't have a lot of people that could give us an educated opinion. So we had a few key people within the department that gave guides. And then Jim Clark, our police attorney, was involved in the process also. So I'll let him answer that for you.
Yes, ma'am, Madam Senator. The actual development of this took place over about a 6 or 8 month period. And what we did was, we obviously had about 15 or 20 different officers that were on the committee from the police department side, myself and another attorney from the city attorney's office, who looked at the policies internally. With regard to the questions of diversity on that, there were males, females, a number of different races and ethnicities that were involved. But we also spoke with and met on a number of occasions with the district attorneys that were present there, obviously, Guilford County District Attorney's Office has a number of people that are attorneys on their staff. We also met with the judges and through our court liaison organization, which is meeting with the various, not just the judges themselves, but with other stakeholders that are in their criminal justice system. We did not consult with the ACLU or the public per se. There was information that was put to the public that we are implementing this program for greater citizen and officer protection. That was the basis for what it is we did. And we also worked with our police foundation. So there were members of the public who were involved there primarily through the Police Foundation, but they were certainly well aware of what it was that we were doing and why. So the development, it wasn't just a policy that was put in place overnight. It took about, I'd say about 7 or 8 months just to get to the first draft stage.
Thank you. Give us your name and agency, just for the record.
Jim Clark, and I'm a police attorney for the Greensboro Police Department.
Thank you. Major Willis, can you respond for your agency when it was first developing this? What was the mix?
The challenge for Charlotte is we had developed a policy very similar to this in the early 90s for our in-car camera system and sought a lot of public involvement then. Quite honestly, that stems from an officer involved shooting. We implemented our in-car cameras in every marked car that we have. We have 645 in-car camera systems now. And our policy for body worn cameras is very similar to that. Leading up to the policy development, there were a lot of, not necessarily public committees, but a lot of public environments in which we sought input, city council sought input from citizens specifically surrounding the implementation of body cameras. And the resounding word from our citizens is that they wanted the police to have to put body cameras. We traditionally have not sat down and really gone through that with our community as far as the development of our policy. I can tell you that once we did develop that, we shared it with the ACLU and gave them an opportunity to give us some points of concern in our policy. And we took, as expected, we took some of those concerns to heart and made a few changes. And as expected, some of those were a little over the top for us, and we didn't make those changes. I mean, I can tell you one in particular was their concern with how long we keep. Because they don't want innocent citizens out there on video and police departments storing it for a long period of time. I don't want it either because I don't want to pay for it. Unless it's associated with a criminal case, very similar to their complaints about criminal intelligence gathering. So we had a lot of public input, but not specific to the policy itself.
Thank you, Major. Any other questions of the committee? Thank you so much. We will let you stay tuned. We'll let you know when our next meeting is, and we'll be talking to several of you for additional information. We stand adjourned.
Thank you.